Well, welcome everybody to the opening weekend of our 2019 practice period. Last night, many of you were here and spoke of your intentions of what you would like to bring forth in the practice period. And for those of you who weren't here, I would encourage you to give that some thought, if you haven't already, about how you would like to express your life during these weeks that we deepen our practice together. I mentioned briefly last night that practice period is a practice of the Sangha. We do this together with other people, not as little hermits off in our bedrooms or wherever we go to meditate. And I think the theme that we're using for this practice period is particularly relevant to this idea of Sangha, because we're going to be talking about our Chinese ancestors, those people who, through their generosity and through their kindness, have passed on their wisdom, their understanding of the Buddha Dharma in a particular way, a particular flavor. We're going to be exploring that this practice period. A special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letters, pointing directly to the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. Now, these are the words that are attributed to an Indian monk named Bodhidharma, who, according to the legend, brought Chan, or Zen teachings, from India into China. And we'll talk more about this quasi-mythic character, Bodhidharma, in the coming week. But I wanted to start with this quote, because we're going to be, as I said, taking up the theme of Chan, or Zen ancestors, and he's the number one guy, according to the legends. Now, I'm sure most of us are aware of this, but just in case, I wanted to say that I've said Chan or Zen. And Zen is simply the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese word Chan. And since Zen seems to be most familiar to people in the West, and I think amongst us as well, for the rest of this talk, I'm simply going to be using the word Zen rather than Chan. So, having read this little quote, and for those of you who are familiar with Zen practice, maybe the theme of focusing on the words of our Chinese ancestors just may chafe a little bit. After all, doesn't Zen practice really not depend on words and letters? Not depend on the scriptures? And surely our practice is really being about in the present moment, honing our awareness and deepening our meditation and insight, pointing directly at the mind, as Bodhidharma wrote. And perhaps also you've read some stories, right, of the Chinese and even Japanese Buddhist scholars who, after being bested by an old tea lady in Dharma combat or by abbots in Zen temples, they abandon all their studies and books just to sit zazen, to sit in meditation practice. And even today, there are a few Zen teachers who insist their students stop reading and simply practice. Just sit, just follow the schedule. Stop your reading. So, while it is true that Zen is a practice-oriented tradition focused on personal experience, it is important that we know from the very beginning, Zen and the practice of Zen, this tradition that arose, also encouraged some study, and also encouraged expression through writing and through painting and other arts. When we read about our Zen ancestors, our Chinese Zen ancestors, as well as the Japanese Zen ancestors, we soon discover that many of them studied and wrote extensively and created art. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who first brought this form of Zen practice from China to Japan, left us volumes of writings. And included in those volumes are many poems that he wrote as well. And these were left for the later generations, for us, to pick up and see what wisdom or understanding was left for us. So for us today, I really think study is important for three main reasons. Now, most of us have really very little knowledge of Asian history or culture, very little knowledge of the kind of historical or philosophical or even psychological underpinnings of the Zen tradition. And so some knowledge of the tradition will help us not wander down kind of unproductive paths and help us drop some of our assumptions that we may have picked up along the way. So through the compassion of our ancestors, we have maps, we have guides. And our task as we read and reflect is to remember that these are simply maps and guides, nothing holy, as Bodhidharma once told the Emperor of China. So the second reason I think we should study is not really to gain knowledge, but actually to challenge the ideas that we already have. In this way, I think study can be a really powerful and critical tool to help cut through our own assumptions, our own set views of life and the world. Certainly, there is no need for us to remember the names of the ancestors or what exactly they said or when. I think it's much more important for us at this point to simply come with a beginner's mind and open-heartedly explore these teachings that have been left to us. Some of these teachings will bore you. Some will be very puzzling. Some will intrigue you or inspire you or maybe shake you in some way. And some may even wake you up. So as we dip in to the teachings of our Chinese ancestors, just listen. Just listen with an open curiosity and see what these teachings tell you about yourself, about this place in the world that we occupy, about this time. You may find that one or maybe more of these old teachers speak directly to your heart of hearts. Or you may find that what they say stirs up something that has laid hidden inside for far too long. So connected to this second reason is that when we read or hear about the virtues and qualities of our Chinese ancestors, maybe we'll get inspired. We'll get inspired to try cultivate these virtues and qualities within ourselves, and then also inspired to offer them out to the world. When I read the stories left to us about their lives, I'm really quite sure this is exactly what they wanted. They want us to stand on their shoulders. That's what they want. And in doing so, they want us to fully meet this life and to fully meet the world unclouded by preconceptions, just as they struggled to do over and over again in their own lives. So these are examples of life lived in the Dharma. And as we see, these stories include warts as well as great beauty. I hope during this practice period, you will meet some of these ancestors of ours, kind of eyebrow to eyebrow. So before we really consider some of these early ancestors, and we'll talk probably about, I don't know, about five or six of them maybe during the practice period, and there's many more to explore. This will just be a sampler. But before we do that, let's kind of set the stage a bit. It's important to know that Zen did not spring fully formed, and nor was it a kind of ready-made tradition that was transmitted from India to China. Although that's how the mythic history kind of portrays it, right? The history of Zen is really a very rich broth of historical fact, powerful myths and stories, and all of those have a really important role to play. It's important to keep in mind that Zen is not a set thing. It didn't spring forth and then that was it. It's been going on in the same way for hundreds of years. It's not a collection of concepts and practices. And it certainly is not the truth with a big T. Zen is a flow. This practice is a flow, including some of the things I just mentioned, yes, but always constantly changing, constantly shifting and adapting, just like everything else. If you go to one of these old Chinese ancestors, eyebrow to eyebrow, and you say, "I understand Zen," you'll get whacked. So, a little background to launch the practice period. Buddhism, this Buddhist tradition, first came into China sometime around the first century in the Common Era. And it was mostly brought by silk traders, or I shouldn't say silk traders, but traders on the Silk Road. There was a lot of trade going on at that time, and known as the Silk Road because silk was highly valued, particularly in the Middle East, in Europe, and almost all of it came from China at that time. So they brought it in, and monks and nuns started to wander in and start teaching as well, very slowly. And so by the second century, that's when translations began of many of the Indian Buddhist texts into Chinese. And yet, you know, still, this new way of religious practice, understood today that we call Buddhism, or the Buddhist way, was perceived and understood by the Chinese through the lens of their own religious tradition of Taoism. The Buddha, at first, was seen as a foreign immortal. Immortality being one of the goals of Taoism, and they had a collection of these characters who had supposedly become immortal through their practice. And Buddha was seen as one of these guys. And breath meditation was seen as another form of Taoist breathing practices, which was very common as well as a way to, again, achieve a kind of immortality. So after about another 200 years, some of the more complicated philosophical texts were being translated, and particularly what we call or know as the Prajnaparamita literature, which means the wisdom literature. This was being translated to Chinese, and the strong emphasis of the Mahayana tradition on emptiness came to be deeply appreciated. So this is kind of another little revolution or change that was going on. Now, emptiness, these teachings of emptiness, also echoed, again, another Taoist understanding. The teaching that nothing has a separate inherent self. This rang really true to the Chinese once they could appreciate the Prajnaparamita literature. And as the early Chinese practitioners understood, this emptiness was not just about things like this or the cup of tea, which, you know, has no inherent existence, it will change. It also applies to the very self. It applies to the individual, to me. And they deeply appreciated one particular text known as the Sunya Sutra. And in this text, Ananda asked the Buddha, "It is said that the world is empty. The world is empty, Lord. In what respect is the world empty?" And the Buddha replied, "Insofar as it is empty of a self, of anything pertaining to a self, this it is said, Ananda, that the world is empty." No self. Nothing permanent. Now this is a really interesting and challenging idea. The Sanskrit word for emptiness is shunyata. And the Chinese searched for quite a while to figure out how to translate this. They decided not to use the direct translation, or at least the translation that would be completely kind of negative, like emptiness, right? Empty car, empty gas tank, empty cup, not so positive. Instead, they chose to write the character for sky to represent emptiness. All things are empty, like the sky. The sky, clear, blue, expansive, but always ready to receive whatever is there. Receive a bird, a kite, a cloud, the sun, the moon, a meteor. Shunyata, far from being a kind of negative view of the world, presents emptiness as that which is beyond all limitation, all boundary. And released of all limitation and all boundary, then there's just intimacy, just connection. Nothing separating, nothing outside. So this understanding doesn't deny, of course, the temporary presence of a bird, a cloud, or a meteor. It's just those things are not how we assume them to be. And carrying that boundlessness of the shunyata a bit further, we are not how we assume ourselves to be either. Nothing separate, nothing unchanging. In the Heart Sutra, which is the very kind of summary of all the Prajnaparamita literature that we chant, and we chant it almost every time we have service, as you know, the line goes, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness is self-form. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese teacher, explained this beautifully as form is the wave, emptiness is the water. Now I said this came into the Chinese understanding fairly early, but again it was kind of a philosophical approach, right? Trying to figure it out, lots of writing, very kind of Indian approach. The Chinese had a very different way. So let me again just go back to Bodhidharma for a moment. He took this concept of shunyata and really brought it to life in the Chinese way. So here's the story. When Bodhidharma is invited by the Emperor of China, which actually wasn't really the Emperor of China. China was broken up in little parts at this time, but that's beside the point. At any rate, but the Emperor of China, and the Emperor of China, a great devout follower of Buddhism, said to Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teaching? And Bodhidharma simply replied, vast emptiness, nothing holy. We'll come back to that maybe in it next week. But this brief dialogue is still resonating and teaching us today, isn't it? Vast emptiness, nothing holy, Bodhidharma says. He says, drop the distinction between the sacred and the profane. See beyond your fixed ideas and views. Nothing holy, nothing profane. What does that mean for our life? What does that mean when you have to clean the cat litter? So roughly at the same time, another Mahayana idea, a teaching, was deeply influencing the Chinese understanding. And this, another Sanskrit word I'm going to give you here is ta-ta-ta, often translated into English as thusness or suchness. And this term indicates the real nature of things, exactly as they are, without our projections, confusions, or elaborations. Now, first, this might seem, oh, it's kind of a scientific or materialistic way of looking at the world, but the ta-ta-ta is much more radical. It is the world uncolored by the narratives and projections of Michael or Susan or Kate or Kay, Pat. Ta-ta-ta, or the thusness of all things, is without the stories, judgments, but especially of oneself. And our practice, the practice of the Bodhisattva path which we're on, is to meet each moment of the world free of the narratives and projections that so often get in the way. Reality is not as we imagine it to be, out there and separate, offering us both pleasure and pain. It is always just as it is. It is always thusness. And how our Chinese ancestors played with this is really interesting. And we'll have lots of little dialogues and stories, I'm sure, through the coming weeks. But let me give you this one. When the young monk Nanyuan came to be a student of the great Huineng, the sixth patriarch in the Zen tradition, he was asked by Huineng, what is it that thus comes? He doesn't say, who are you? What is it that thus comes? So in other words, show me the person before the name, before you have all these ideas about being a bad monk, a good monk, a young monk, a stupid monk. What is it that thus comes? And like Nanyuan, through our practice, we too have to answer this question. We too must answer here Now, what is it that thus comes? Now, one more example. A monk in training asked the great teacher, Mazu, what's the meaning of Zen? And Mazu replied, what's the meaning of now? I got to remember that one, so the next time someone comes in and says, can you explain what Zen is? But again, how would you answer the old Mazu? This too is our question. So if we're going to bring forth our life, what is the meaning of now? This teaching of Tathāgata in the Indian philosophers, the Indian philosophers kind of picked it up and they expanded it and massaged it into something known as the Tathāgarbha, which means the womb of thusness. But that's quite a mouthful to always say, the womb of thusness. And another way to that it's kind of being translated, I guess I would say, or is simply called Buddha nature. The Buddha nature of things. It's funny, you know, when I hear the word Tathāgarbha, I imagine a Buddha kind of like a baby waiting to be born somewhere. But that somewhere is right here. That somewhere is you. For me, this word evokes a kind of process and creativity that lies at the heart of all of us. Suzuki Roshi, the Japanese monk who brought this form of practice from China, from Japan to North America, said, to be human, to be a human being is to be a Buddha. Buddha nature is just another name for human nature, our true human nature. So I enjoy reading things like that, but really it doesn't help that much. As long as I think, well, how can a schmuck like me really be a Buddha? Maybe you have similar thoughts. But this is kind of one of the key driving forces of our practice. Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan that I mentioned just a little bit ago, when he was a young man, he left his training temple, beautiful mountain near Kyoto, Mount Hiei, to search for the true meaning of Buddha nature, because he had this deep, pressing question. How can a schmuck like me be a Buddha? But he said it much more eloquently. He said, both esoteric and exoteric teachings explain that a person, in essence, has true Dharma nature, and is originally a body of Buddha nature. If so, why do all Buddhas in the past, present, and future arouse a wish for and seek enlightenment? So in other words, wait a minute, if we have Buddha nature, why am I stuck here? Right? That's his very question. Don't you have a similar question? And they're echoing through the centuries. Huineng, the sixth Chinese patriarch of the Chan of the Zen tradition, which I mentioned just a bit ago, he put our human situation like this in a writing he left us known as the Platform Sutra. He wrote, or someone wrote for him, good friends, you already possess the prajna wisdom of awakening. Because your minds are deluded, you cannot understand by yourselves. Good friends, Buddha nature isn't different for the ignorant and the wise. It's just that people are deluded or awake. When people are deluded, they're ignorant. When they're awake, they become wise. So this sounds simple enough. Yet, to go about it, how do we do that? Well, I suppose the short answer is we each must kind of feel our way to becoming awake. And yet, to further muddy the waters, at some point, we have to, if we're going to really awaken, have to even let go of the desire to be awake. So deeply in the present moment. So here's another little Zen story, again, illustrating that point. So remember I mentioned the Mazu just a bit ago? Well, in this story, he's a student. And his teacher is Nanyue. So here goes the story. Nanyue saw his student Mazu diligently meditating under a tree. So Mazu was a good student, eh? Meditating away during the break under a tree. So Nanyue went up to his student and asked, "Oh, great monastic." I think he's being sarcastic here. "Great monastic. What do you intend by doing zazen?" And Mazu, being a little bit naive perhaps, replied, "I'm intending to be a Buddha." And then Nanyue picked up a brick and started to polish it. And Mazu, seeing his teacher doing this rather bizarre thing, said, "What are you doing?" And Nanyue said, "I'm making a mirror." And Mazu said, "How can you make a mirror by polishing a brick?" And Nanyue replied, "How can you become a Buddha by doing zazen?" Now, this is not to say that practice is unnecessary. But after we have gone on long enough in our practice and calm down, maybe at some point we open up to the truth that really there is nowhere to go, nowhere to get there, because we have been here all along. I'm trying to remember the poet who said something, I can't remember the line now, but it just occurred to me. We come home and realize it for the first time. T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot. I think it's kind of like that. Yeah. Norman wrote a book on the Odyssey, which is essentially a story of leaving home and sailing around, having all things, but coming back and really finding it for the first time. So there'll be lots more stories in the coming weeks. But the other thing I wanted to highlight here, just going back to the history of all this, is that really until the beginning of the 9th century, so I mean, like we have, you know, about 500 years or more, Buddhist monastics basically all lived together, regardless of the particular school of thought that they embraced or the kind of practices that they did. There were many other kind of practices that were being done in China at this time, chanting and fasting and pilgrimage, those type of things. Everyone lived together, practiced together, and probably argued and did that. But by the time we do get to the 9th century, we see that Zen teachers and students tended to set up in more isolated places, better suited to practice meditation. And these were in the mountains or, anyway, far from cities, far from towns, away from distractions. So by the end of the 9th century, which is getting to at the end of the Tang period, this great Chinese period of great Chinese dynasty where there was a lot of flourishing, by the end of that period, the government had lost control chaos swept through China. And many of the temples were destroyed. However, the temples and the monasteries that kind of had embraced Zen practice as the main practice, they were all tucked away in the mountains and tucked away in these isolated places, and they survived. Whereas the other Buddhist temples in the big cities and towns really suffered destruction, almost completely wiped out during this period of tremendous chaos. And so when order was reestablished in China and again government back in control, Zen was the practice that kind of filled the vacuum. And so in China, from the next main period onwards, it was the practice of Chan, of Zen meditation, and the practice of chanting of Buddha's name that became the main practices in China. Oops, okay. So when order was reestablished, again, as I said, Zen became reestablished. But the ways of instructing the young monks and nuns changed a bit. And again, Zen adapted to the times. And at this point, well, as I said earlier, the study of traditional sutras, etc., that one was never completely abandoned, but much more emphasis was placed on the stories that I've just mentioned, the kind of recorded words of our earlier Zen, of our earlier Chinese teachers of Zen, who had kind of realized the spirit of the sutras and were teaching them in a way that opened it up to Chinese culture. So during this period of time, known as the Song period, this is when the teaching methods that we're familiar with today became firmly established and part of the Zen practice and continues on till today. And again, we're kind of changing them, massaging them a little bit. But although, you know, these practices and teaching methods changed to meet the needs of the times, the basic problem of the human condition was always forefront, just as it is today. The question of suffering, dissatisfaction, that's what brought the monks and nuns to the meditation hall, just as it brings us to the Zendo today. But most markedly, unlike the long discourses and explanations that we see in early Chinese Buddhism or in the Indian tradition, the Chinese Zen teachers spoke really bluntly and at times with great humor, really cutting to the heart of the matter. So here's an example. A monk inquired of Master Yunmen, one of the great last Chinese Zen masters, "What's the problem? What's the problem? Why am I unhappy?" And Yunmen replied, "You don't notice the stench of your own shit." Now, isn't that the earthy truth? Our own propensity for separation, like, you know, my time in the toilet doesn't stink as much as everyone else's time in the toilet. How directly Yunmen speaks to us. Then you cut. "Oh, let's talk about suffering, my son." He doesn't do that. Thusness, emptiness, Buddha nature, these are some of the key views, key concepts that really underpin our Zen practice. But I think, as you can already see, the Chinese Zen ancestors were not much interested in discussing what these words mean or represent. They wanted their students to awaken to the truth of living a full human life, not just some abstract idea. not to just have hold on to that. And the Chinese and ancestors understood that these three big teachings that came into China, and there's more that we could talk about, but these three positions are not really different. They're just different ways of looking at the same thing. Emptiness, thusness, and Buddha nature, from the standpoint of some kind of absolute truth, cannot be separate. They're inseparable. But our Chinese Zen ancestors would use these to really help any baffled student. And often they would use these in a way to pull the carpet out from under their feet. You think you got the answer? Zip. Here's a brief dialogue between the great teacher Shirto and his student Dadian. So Dadian said, "My mind is just like your mind." Right? Oh, no separation. This guy's got it, right? But Shirto says, "My mind has nothing whatsoever to do with your mind." Dadian then said, "Ah, originally nothing exists. The great teaching of emptiness." Shirto said, "In that case, you don't have an original face." Dadian then said, "Emptiness is the real state of things, right?" And Shirto replied, "In that case, phenomena can't be grasped. What is all this stuff here then if everything's empty?" That's the correct understanding, you dolt. You should try remembering that next time. In our practice, as Shirto is trying to compassionately teach his student, we have to have the view of the relative and the absolute at the same time. We have to realize the truth of this world is as we see it, and the truth of the world as we don't see it. Not this, not that. What's left? Answer quickly. It's my deep hope that during this practice period, that one of our Chinese ancestors that we'll bring forth will pull the carpet out from under your feet. During these weeks, please remember that all these teachings are not the truth itself. All these teachings are but signs pointing to that which can never be clearly described to begin with. I think these Chinese ancestors of ours deeply realized that. And in their compassion, they left their teachings for us. They left them as, not as treasures, but just as maps. I hope some of this will be useful for you, and I hope some of it will be useful for me as I struggle with this too. And I look forward to practicing with you over these weeks. Thank you. Thank you.